I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. In a time before psychiatric medications, mental institutions were often called snake pits because of the appalling conditions for patients for whom there was so little treatment. Neurologist Walter Freeman believed that transorbital lobotomies could bring them some relief from their delusions and depression and anxiety. He first performed these procedures in secret, but before long he was traveling the country performing multiple lobotomies a day on people, including children who were not remotely psychotic. His story is a centerpiece of Sam Keen's new book, The Ice Pick Surgeon. It's a cautionary tale about science gone wrong and scientists who were so blinded by their ambition and belief in their own brilliance that they could not see the harm that they were doing. Sam Keen joins us on Radio Times today to, frankly, tell us some of these gruesome stories and the importance of putting character and ethics first when doing science. His other books include The Disappearing Spoon, The Violinist's Thumb, and The Dueling Neurosurgeons. Sam Keen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Well, quoting from your book, why were you interested in, quote, what pushes men and women to cross the line and commit crimes and misdeeds in the name of science? What got you going on this?
Well, I'm always really interested in the human side of science. So talking about, you know, the joys and sorrows, all the emotions that go into science, just really making it more of a human experience. And there is, you know, on occasion sort of a dark side to science. And I guess what I was really fascinated with was this idea that usually the pursuit of knowledge is a good thing. It's what drives scientists, what makes them work hard, what makes them want to discover things. But sometimes some people do get so obsessed with some topic or idea that they trample ethical boundaries and even commit crimes in the name of their science. And so what the book does is basically look at different types of crimes and scientists who committed those crimes. Piracy, espionage, murder, all sorts of different things.
And we will get to all of that. You do begin with a quote from Albert Einstein, who said, most people say that it is the intellect which makes a great scientist. They are wrong. It is character. That's Albert Einstein. Can you add to that?
I think what he was really saying there is that, I mean, a couple things, actually, that science is really built on trust. You really have to trust other people, and you really have to believe that they are not doing basic things like, you know, faking results, stuff like that. But beyond that, I think there's another sort of deeper interpretation where he's talking about the fact that if you compromise your morals for scientific progress, you often end up with neither one of those things. You get neither the morals or the scientific progress. And that's something that really, kind of each chapter in the book kind of reinforced that for me, that in some ways, unethical science is ipso facto bad science.
Is intelligence, though, from your perspective, overrated when it comes to science?
I don't think it's overrated. It's one of those sufficient and necessary condition things where, you know, it is important, obviously, but it's not the only thing. And maybe we've sort of overemphasized that and underemphasized the character part.
Let me ask you about the timing of this book, because there is a sizable portion of this population here in the United States, other countries as well, that believe, for instance, that the COVID vaccine is a hoax or it's dangerous or it's ineffective, that Dr. Fauci is a charlatan or has malign intent. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation about vaccines that are, you know, very much sort of alive and well in the land. Your book is about science gone wrong. Help us understand the difference between these two.
Well, I think it's exactly what you said. There's misinformation and disinformation where people do not have correct information about the actual science that's going on. These cases are cases where people did something unethical or, you know, just went way too far in pursuing this science. So there's a difference between people not trusting normal everyday science and people actually doing wrong, morally abhorrent things. And it's just a matter of, you know, I guess trying to draw the line between those two things. And I don't think in most cases it's that hard to draw. When you have people, working for months and years to put out vaccines and things, that's not the same at all as someone, committing or doing lobotomies or doing other things like that.
Well, let's talk about lobotomies and let's talk about Walter Freeman. He's the neuroscientist who developed the transorbital lobotomy. Help us understand, and perhaps I mentioned this in my introduction, but so take us back to what it was like in, let's say, the 1920s, 30s, even into the 1940s, if you were institutionalized at a mental institution. What was it like?
Yeah, it was pretty horrific in most cases. This is going back to a time where they did not have any pharmaceuticals to help people with psychiatric disorders. I mean, there were no effective treatments, zero. So doctors were desperate, patients were desperate, families were desperate. They needed something, they wanted something to help people who were suffering gravely. And it sounds kind of crazy today. People, have seen movies, they've seen things, but at the very beginning and in certain limited circumstances, lobotomies were a defensible treatment. When you had an actual neurosurgeon going in, doing work on a limited area of the brain, sometimes it did calm people down. And these were people who would be locked in a padded cell, who would be straitjacketed. They would shove their meals in through a little slot in the door. They couldn't go outside. They couldn't just sit down and have a meal with somebody. And in those limited circumstances, as a last resort, when there were no other treatments, again, lobotomies were a defensible treatment. The problem, though, is that Walter Freeman was not content to just sort of let things be. He got ambitious. I think he saw himself as a bit of a messiah. And instead of turning things over to an actual neurosurgeon, he was just a neurologist, not an actual surgeon. Instead of letting the surgeons handle things and do it slowly as a last resort, he became, as someone called him, and he was very proud of this name, he became the Henry Ford of lobotomies. He wanted to mass produce lobotomies. He wanted to go out there and do dozens a day and do them on children so they never got to an asylum in the first place, even though some of them probably wouldn't have ended up in those places. So he really, his ambition and his desire to do as many as possible, he thought he was going to save the world. He thought he was going to save every person in an asylum, but he ended up causing a lot more harm than he probably was preventing.
I'm looking at actually a New York Times article from 1937 saying that people with the following symptoms could benefit from a lobotomy. And here's what they described as the symptoms: tension, apprehension, anxiety, depression, insomnia, suicidal ideas, delusions, hallucinations, crying spells, melancholia, obsessions, panic states, disorientation, nervous indigestion, and hysterical paralysis. And this was back in the 1930s. But nonetheless, that covers most maladies, it seems, most mental health maladies.
Yeah, I mean, you just pick up like a copy of the DSM or something, and pretty much everything in there supposedly this could cure. But yeah, it was seen as basically by its more zealous adherents, it was seen as kind of a cure-all. And they were very good about ginning up publicity. Walter Freeman, the lobotomist, the ice pick surgeon, was a very charismatic person. He would have reporters with him. He would be cracking jokes while he was doing lobotomies. He was actually a fairly ambidextrous, so he could do two lobotomies at once, one with each hand, and he would get people, snapping pictures of things like that. So he really understood the power of publicity, but used it in sort of a nefarious way.
You describe some of his patients losing kind of a sparkle. And to be perfectly honest with you, years ago, I had a friend whose grandmother had a lobotomy. She had a germ phobia. It really, kept her from literally going outside because she was so afraid of germs. She had a lobotomy. She seemed like a very nice older woman, but according to my friend, sort of lost. I think you described the word that. The word sparkle, that she just seemed kind of had a kind of dulled affect. She was able to go to the mailbox to get her mail, but nonetheless, didn't cure her, but it probably made her life a little less anxious.
Yeah, it might have. And again, for people with the sort of extreme end of things, or even some people who weren't that extreme, it did help them with certain symptoms. But as you said, they really lost the sparkle. I remember stories of people, they would just sit in their room all day staring at nothing, just kind of doing nothing. If you came up to them and said, hey, you want to go outside for a walk? They'd say, okay, sure. And they would kind of follow along and do whatever. But they would never initiate that themselves. They didn't seem to really have any drives or wants, or really they didn't want to do anything unless someone said something, and then they'd kind of go along without much enthusiasm. And you actually see that in probably the most famous lobotomy case, which was Rosemary Kennedy, JFK's sister. And I talk about how Walter Freeman was involved in that case. And you kind of see the same sort of thing with her, where she just was institutionalized for the rest of her life and really lost the spark and the sparkle that she had. Kind of the things that make us feel like we're human, they just get erased in some cases.
And why did she have a lobotomy, JFK's sister?
There were a couple of reasons. She was a little, they thought, too high-spirited. They were frankly worried that she was going to be an embarrassment on the family. When she was born, the umbilical cord got wrapped around her neck and she lost oxygen to her brain for a while. And she was always a little slow. She had some developmental disorders. And frankly, the family was embarrassed about her. And they kept her in a convent, wouldn't let her go out. She kept sneaking out in the middle of the night. They assumed, I don't know if this is true or not, but they assumed she was going out, might be meeting men, doing things like that. And they were worried she was going to get pregnant and that it was going to ruin the family's chances of having someone in the White House. And the lobotomy was what they saw as the solution.
And was it the lobotomy that, in a sense, sort of put her in an institution for the rest of her life?
Yes. After that, she lost her sparkle. She lost the ability to kind of use the bathroom on her own. She couldn't really walk after that. They had to rehabilitate her. And after that, she essentially had no choice but be in an institution.
We're almost up in a break here. All Things Considered actually did a story of almost 20 years ago called My Lobotomy, Howard Dully's Journey. Mm-hmm. And he's quoted as saying, he had a lobotomy when he was 12. If you saw me, you'd never know I had a lobotomy. The only thing you'd notice is that I'm very tall and I weigh 350 pounds. But I always felt different, wondered if something was missing from my soul.
Yeah, and he was fairly high functioning. He was able to go out in society, things like that. But other people weren't so lucky. I think they ended up with much worse outcomes than he did. I mean, not that he was lucky, but right. In comparison to the way some people ended up, they ended up in much worse situations. And kind of the sad part is that Walter Freeman didn't really do any controlled studies or anything where he would compare the outcomes of different people. He just went in and did it and sort of wreaked havoc in this swath across most of the United States.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Sam Keen, our guest on Radio Times today. The physician that we were talking about, Walter Freeman, is, in a sense, the title of his new book. It's called The Ice Pick Surgeon, Murder, Fraud, Sabotage, Piracy, and Other Dastardly Deeds Perpetrated in the Name of Science. You can join our conversation by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Back in the 1940s, neurologist Walter Freeman developed the use of lobotomies to treat mental illness. We're talking with writer Sam Keen about scientists so obsessed with their discoveries and so sure of their brilliance that they ignore the harm that they have done. Sam Keen's new book is called The Ice Pick Surgeon. I just have a couple more questions about Walter Freeman. And when you talk about ice pick, we're literally talking about an ice pick, right? That was really his first tool when he began to do these transorbital lobotomies.
Yeah, he was trying to develop a new procedure. So instead of having to open up the top of the skull and operate like a neurosurgeon would, he wanted basically outpatient neurosurgery, which sounds kind of crazy. And other people at the time thought it was crazy, but that's what he wanted. And he developed a way, an idea to go in through the eye socket. But he needed a certain tool, a certain length, a certain strength. And he was really, he was at a loss to figure out what tool this could be, what he could use, till he opened up his kitchen drawer one day, saw an ice pick there, and had an epiphany. And the first tool he used for these operations was the actual ice pick that he found in his kitchen drawer. And he did these in secret in the row house office he had in Washington, D.C., because he knew that other people would be horrified if they found out about this. And they eventually were.
Well, indeed. And just to help our listeners understand, and again, this is a bit gruesome, but nonetheless, so you go through the eye socket and essentially kind of severing the connections to the frontal lobe. Is that what he was doing?
Yeah. So you have the limbic system, which is in sort of the center of the brain that's involved in emotions, things like that. And you have the frontal lobe in the brain, which is involved in reasoning, planning, things like that. And the theory at the time was that the emotional centers of the brain were kind of getting revved up and that they were overwhelming the thinking and reasoning parts, the planning parts of the brain. So by severing the connections between the frontal reasoning planning parts and the emotional limbic parts, you could sort of cut down on that ability of emotions to override the planning part of the brain. And in some cases, that was what was happening to people. However, they had sort of a crude understanding of how the brain worked then, and they didn't realize that there are feedback mechanisms and that it's not as simple as they were assuming. So they were going in and they were damaging not only other parts of the brain, but also some of the feedbacks that maybe could have helped people on their own to tamp down on their emotions or to learn to control their problems in other ways.
And he was not a neurosurgeon. We should just underscore that fact.
He was not a neurosurgeon, no. He was a world-class expert on the anatomy of the brain, and he was a good neurologist, but no, he was not a neurosurgeon.
And when's the last time he did he's no longer with us, but when was the last time he did a lobotomy?
In the late 1960s, he eventually moved from Washington, D.C. out to California. And he had a woman on the table. This was her third lobotomy, believe it or not. And he had a bad track record of nicking arteries in the brain and people almost bleeding out on the table or actually bleeding out on the table. And this time he got unlucky and the woman died on the table. And that was, again, her third one. And after that, he got banned from performing the procedure.
Is medicine, I have to say, looking through your book, and you don't detail every single case of medical malfeasance, but is medicine kind of prone to this kind of, egomaniacal potential for fraud?
I don't think that it's prone to it. I mean, there are lots of people out there doing really great work, and most of the people involved want to help people. Even in the cases in this book where people go completely off the rails sometimes, they're at the core of what they're trying to do is help people. It's just that they sort of trample – it's sort of a means and fallacy where they have this vision of what the world is going to be like, and they think, you know, you got to break a few eggs in the meantime. So I don't think there's anything intrinsic about medicine. I think it's more that medicine involves human beings. So maybe – it's, you know, when you're dealing with physics or something, you can do bad things sometimes, but it's not people that are going to be harmed necessarily, whereas medicine is just a people-centric science in the first place. So there are more cases of medicine in the book than there are others, but there's also paleontologists doing bad things, or physicists doing bad things, botanists doing bad things. So it kind of runs the gamut, and I think that, yeah, unethical science can appear in any field.
What's so interesting is we're talking about Walter Freeman and lobotomy, so we're talking about the 30s, 40s, 50s, and then when you get – kind of, well, you've got the war, you've got the Nazi doctors doing unspeakable experiments during World War II. Then you've got the post-Cold War, or the Cold War, I should say, and you've got Tuskegee, and you write about some Guatemalan studies of STDs that also raised a whole host of ethical questions. Was there something sort of unique about this time period?
I think it was a time when science was really coming into its own. It was getting a lot of money. Partly due to the World War II and the Cold War, so money was coming in. Lots more people were rushing into science. I think before this, science was a bit of a genteel occupation where fewer people were involved, and now all of a sudden you had a rush of people involved. And I think there was a sense that you can just sort of trust scientists to do the good thing. And I think World War II exposed that. You had the Nazi doctor experiments coming out. And over in Europe, they developed the Nuremberg Code to govern the way we treat patients during medical research. But what was really crazy, and I talk about this in the book, was that you had studies like Tuskegee, like the Guatemalan STD study, which was even more horrific in some ways, going on at the exact same time that they were devising these codes in Europe. And you just really see this blind spot with people where they thought that unethical science was something that someone else does, that it happens over there, not a sense that it can happen here as well.
Well, let me ask you about the Guatemala study. Frankly, I had not heard of it until I read your book. And this was a scientist, John Cutler, training OBGYNs. What was this science about?
It was John Cutler. Yeah, he was at the OBGYN training was actually later. This was about trying to basically cure venereal diseases. He started off during World War II, and it was a surprisingly pressing issue during World War II, where they were trying to basically prevent soldiers from having to miss out on days because of venereal diseases that they had. And they estimated something like they were going to lose 7 aircraft carriers worth of soldiers each year just being down to due to venereal diseases.
Wow.
So it was a pressing problem, and he wanted to fix this. And was trying various ways to develop ointments, cures, things like that. But he needed to test these things. And he started off testing them on prisoners in Indiana. And when that study shut down, he went down to Guatemala and basically had free rein to infect people with STDs without telling them what he was doing. So he would lure them into the clinic and say, you know, I'm giving you free treatments for something, giving you health shots, whatever it might be. And he would get them in there, and then he would infect them with these diseases and try to see if these ointments or whatever could cure them. So he was really kind of running wild down there, doing whatever he wanted.
Well, and you also say, and you know, people are complicated, that he also had probably a much more accepting attitude towards gay victims of AIDS at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the OBGYN work you were talking about, after this Guatemala, this horrific STD study ended, he went over to developing countries and he would develop obstetricians there so that they could deliver babies without women dying. He would bring them over to the U.S. and train them. He was also very outspoken about not stigmatizing HIV in the 1980s, especially when people were, you know, basically coming out and saying awful things about gay people because they were getting HIV at higher rates. So if you had just read his obituary when he died, I think around 2003, you would have thought he was Albert Schweitzer. I mean, it looked like he did all these amazing things. But then a few years after he died, all of this stuff came out that they'd been hiding about the Guatemala study. And then it looks like he's just a horrific person. So people really are complicated. And it's really hard sometimes to figure out how people go off the rails. And one thing I tried to do in this book is kind of show the similarities you see among different cases. You really get into the psychology and the mental aspect of what these people are doing and the psychology of going rogue and breaking bad.
I mean, the idea of a kind of tunnel vision, right? I'm thinking of the VD studies. He directly injected VD into people's bodies, correct?
Yeah, he injected it into their eyes. He would inject it into their arm. He would scrape their genitals and kind of rub it in there. And yeah, he just basically, his goal was to end STDs, and whatever it took to get there, that's what he was willing to do. So tunnel vision is a bad warning sign when people are focused on just that one thing and nothing else. You also see a lot of euphemisms where people dress it up in language that makes it seem more palatable. And yeah, other sort of psychological tricks that they can pull to essentially make it seem like they're not doing the harm that they are.
Hmm. That is Sam Keen, and we're talking about his new book. It's called The Ice Pick Surgeon, with a long subtitle, Murder, Fraud, Sabotage, Piracy, and Other Dastardly Deeds Perpetrated in the Name of Science. He's written other books about scientific issues as well. And again, you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Steve has a question. He says, the British Medical Journal showed that for some of the most common elective orthopedic surgeries, there may not be proof showing that they are better than non-surgical treatments, yet thousands of these surgeries are performed every day. Where would you place those surgeons who continue to perform these treatments despite the lack of medical evidence of their efficacy? Are they any more or less ethical than Walter Freeman?
I think they're definitely more ethical than Walter Freeman.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, and it science is complicated, especially when you're talking about the human body. And there, I think, was good reasons to think that these surgeries would be a better option at the beginning, and it turns out that maybe they're not. And I do think there is, it's a sort of a psychological question of why human beings, we go for these big dramatic surgeries where you're opening people up, and sort of there's a bit of machismo involved where people want to do difficult surgeries. But in those cases, they had good reason to think that they would work. And I think where you could start to see things get unethical is people persisting in this after it's clear that they should be moving away from it. But right now we're kind of in that phase where we're gathering evidence and weighing it, and we just need to kind of go out and make sure that the evidence is there before we change the situation. So no, they're not in the same class as Walter Freeman.
Let's talk about Henry Murray. This was a Harvard professor. He was doing experiments involving verbal abuse. How did that work?
So basically, he was at Harvard, and he would get some undergraduates there. And he was, it's not quite clear, but this was an era when a lot of psychologists were working for the Central Intelligence Agency. And a lot of the records have been destroyed, so we don't have evidence that he was working for them. But he was definitely involved with that type of work, and definitely had connections in the intelligence community. And he was basically fascinated, did some work on this in World War II, actually. He was fascinated by the interrogatee dynamic, and how to break people down, how essentially to break their will and to break their values. And then sort of you could manipulate them at that point. So he decided to try to figure out the best and most effective way to manipulate people. By bringing them in under false pretenses, he claimed that it was just going to be a friendly discussion with another student about their philosophy on life, I think is how he put it. He did not tell them that the other supposed student was actually just a young-looking and very talented lawyer who was coached to be very aggressive and to be very verbally verbally abusive to them, and to try to humiliate them. And pretty much most all of the people that were in this study remember it being a horrific experience. They would go back week after week after week, some of them for several years.
Why would they go back week after week after week?
In some cases, they needed money. He was paying them. He was a very wealthy blue blood person. He, you know, had his family grew up in a brownstone in what's now Rockefeller Center. He went to all the right schools, all the right places. He was just a very wealthy person. And in fact, he underwrote a lot of the budget for his department himself. If there was a budget shortfall, he would just get his checkbook out and just write him. So he had plenty of money, and some students needed to come back. For that reason. And other students were just stubborn. And they said, you know what, I'm not going to let this person get away with that. I'm going to keep coming back over and over. Including the best example of that was the most famous person who underwent this psychological abuse study. And that was a young man named Ted Kaczynski, yeah, who is better known as the Unabomber today. And he was one of the 22 people that underwent this psychological abuse while he was an undergraduate at Harvard. And he remembered that being probably the worst experience of his life. He showed up a very, in some ways, kind of a fragile person. He came from a bit of a rough home environment psychologically and got into this experiment. And in some ways, it really kind of broke him.
Well, in fact, you quote him as saying, not only the worst experience of my life, but he also said, I wanted to prove I could take it and that mm-hmm. I could not be broken. Now, can we, yes. you know, can we say because of this, he became the Unabomber? I don't think you're arguing that, but it is a worrisome coincidence, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, that's simplistic to say that it just made him the Unabomber, but I think it was one of the things that really drove him and kind of broke him mentally. I think right after the Unabomber case broke, a lot of people were making the connection that, oh, Ted Kaczynski taught at Berkeley in the late 1960s, and Berkeley was a very radical place then. That is where he must have become radicalized. But Kaczynski himself said, no, that's not true. He first formed his views about how he wanted to get revenge on society when he was an undergrad at Harvard. So while he was undergoing this psychologically abusive study, that's when he decided he hated society. That's when he decided he wanted to get revenge on society however he could. And it might be a coincidence, but I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah. And we're talking about he underwent almost 200 hours of abuse.
Yeah. He went back week after week for 200 sessions of this. And sometimes Murray would film the students while they were sputtering and crying, show the films to them to just reinforce the abuse, things like that.
Wow. Let's take another break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Sam Keen is our guest. He's written a number of books. In fact, has been a guest on Radio Times in the past talking about some of them. He's got a brand new one called The Ice Pick Surgeon, Murder, Fraud, Sabotage, Piracy, and Other Dastardly Deeds Perpetrated in the Name of Science. We've got much more to talk about, and we do want to hear from you. Any questions or comments or reactions, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Sam Keen about scientists so obsessed with discovery and the pursuit of knowledge and their own brilliance that they consciously ignored the harm and the pain that they have inflicted. Again, the subject of his new book, The Ice Pick Surgeon. Sam, Avi has a question. Was there any significant criticism of these practices at the time? If so, how did some of these surgeons and scientists respond?
Yeah, there was. And that's one thing I kind of talk about at different points in the book, that, you know, it's sort of easy to criticize certain practices in the past because they didn't think about the world and ethics in the same way that we do nowadays. But in most of these cases in the book, there were people criticizing them at the time and people saying, you shouldn't do this, you can't do this, stuff like that. So, yeah, there were people criticizing them. And in some cases, as with Walter Freeman,
At the beginning of his career, he would, when people criticized him, said, you know, you can't keep doing this, can't do 25 lobotomies a day and just drive to the next town. He would say, well, what other alternatives do we have? We don't have any drugs to treat them. We don't have this to treat them, things like that. So there was bluster in some cases was the response. In other cases, when there was no alternative, people were desperate for solutions and they would just kind of go along with whatever might work. They were basically willing to take that risk.
Let me go from, we were talking about Henry Murray before the break. This is the Harvard professor who was doing these verbal abuse experiments. And I wanted to jump to MK Ultra that you also write about. And this is the CIA doing mind control experiments. And then even jumping up to the more present day, having to do with, you know, harsh isn't exactly the right word, but abusive interrogations. Involving, you know, Guantanamo Bay and people accused of being involved in the September 11th attack on the United States. Can you see a direct line there?
Oh, definitely. And this, I mean, historians have made this connection pretty directly, where you see the same general ideas about abusive interrogation techniques developed during the Cold War by certain people. And you see a direct link to what they were doing in the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars to detainees. Yeah. And that's something I really did strive to make clear in the book, that, you know, the cases, they still are casting a shadow to today. You see these abusive interrogation techniques. You see, you know, vaccine hesitancy because of awful experiments on people, things like that. So you do really see how these cases from the past are still looming large in some ways and affecting society nowadays. I really kind of draw that out in each chapter whenever I can.
And just to underscore that, the Tuskegee experiments still cast that shadow today, correct?
Yeah, causing a lot of mistrust in a lot of communities, yeah, Tuskegee especially.
Well, let's go back a couple of centuries, and you also write about the role of, frankly, slavery and science. Isaac Newton, who was apparently an abolitionist, also wanted to get information about tides, as you write. And one of the ways to get some of that information was to get it from slave ships that were obviously, you know, traveling the oceans. Expand on that.
Yeah, so basically there were a lot of scientists, European scientists at the time, who, of course, they didn't know about North and South America until the late 1400s. And they were seeing specimens from places that they'd never heard of. And they were very excited about this. They were interested in this. They wanted to go there, or they wanted to get data from these places. But they didn't have government-funded science programs at the time that would send people out on expeditions. And in a lot of cases, the only people visiting these lands that they wanted to go to were slave ships. They were going down to Africa, picking up slaves, sailing across the ocean, dropping them off in places in North and South America and the Caribbean. And to get to those places, these scientists decided that to them it was worth it to either tag along on slave ships or to pay these slavers to gather data while they were involved in the slave trade. And this is kind of a new area of history that's emerging right now, is these links between early science and the slave trade, and just how dependent on the slave trade early science was, and how it really, in a lot of cases, the science would not have happened if not for the slave trade. Because, again, that was the only way that a lot of these scientists could get to these places.
Well, in fact, Henry Smeithman, I believe I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, again, opposed the slave trade, but used slave ships in order to get his work back to England, because that was the more efficient route.
Yeah, so he was an early naturalist, early biologist, and he was an ardent abolitionist when he went down to Sierra Leone, which is where he did a lot of his most important work. But you see him start to slowly compromise himself, and step by step. And it's really sort of disheartening and kind of heartbreaking to watch this happen to him. And obviously he was not the real victim here. That was the people being enslaved. But it's really, I think, a good case study of how someone can get so obsessed again and that they really compromise their morals. So he went from being an ardent abolitionist to someone who was willing to travel on slave ships, sort of take advantage of the infrastructure, to someone who at the end was actually dabbling in the slave trade himself because he needed supplies, he needed money, and he decided that getting the data was the more important thing to him.
And happened incrementally, right?
Yeah, and yeah, you really see it happen slowly by slowly, step by step.
We were talking earlier about lobotomies. Doug commented that Dorothy Parker said, "I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy." I remember that quote. Just to put that out there.
I don't know. Dorothy Parker seems a little early for that. I thought it was from a Tom Waits song or something. But it's probably one of those that's attributed to everyone.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about grave robbers while we're sort of walking through history here. And as you describe it, I mean, this was obviously what we're talking largely England, what, 1800s, 1700s?
Yeah, England and the United States. And in fact, sort of one of the wilder stories I talk about in the book is the anatomy riot that happened in the United States in New York in, I believe it was 1788, where you had doctors who needed bodies to dissect to learn about how the body worked to help cure diseases. So again, they really had their heart was in the right place, and that they wanted to help people. They wanted to cure diseases. But because people did not donate bodies to science then, they essentially took to robbing graves, stealing bodies, and then dissecting them after that. They would brush the dirt off, and then they would do their work on these bodies. And people got tired of it. They were going after usually poor people or minorities, immigrants. Those were the bodies that usually got stolen. And eventually, every once in a while, the people would rise up and they would march on a hospital and they would smash the windows. They would drag the bodies out and rebury them. And the New York one is probably the most famous one. Alexander Hamilton was actually, you know, made a bit of a cameo in this story. He begged them not to destroy Columbia University's medical school because there were thousands of people outside willing to or waiting to destroy it, essentially. But it wasn't just in New York. There was something like 17 different anatomy riots at different cities around the United States during the early Republic. So this was a very, very common thing, where people got sick of doctors robbing graves and would essentially go out and burn hospitals down, smash windows, attack the doctors themselves.
Well, there was also an anatomist named John Hunter, as you described, revered for his discoveries and reviled for his methods. But he, you know, he advanced medicine in profound ways, as you write.
He did. He was the first one to discover a lot of different structures in the body, how the body was put together in a lot of ways. He really, really did a good job advancing science. At the same time, he was involved in robbing thousands of graves, and in some cases did even sketchier things where people would explicitly tell him, "No, I do not want my body dissected after death." And he would bribe people. He would, you know, steal their bodies, employ agents to break into their coffins and things. And so he was really low down and ruthless and willing to do whatever it took when he found a specimen that he wanted.
You have a chapter on animals, and I have to say, Sam Keen, I just skipped over that. I cannot read about animals being, it's weird because we're talking about humans being abused,
right.
But I cannot read about animals being abused in the name of science. But we know, of course, that has happened and probably still continues to happen.
It does, yeah. That chapter specifically was about Thomas Edison, who, you know, we all think about him as sort of this American saint, but he was a rather ruthless business person, and in order to discredit his business rivals, he essentially took to abusing animals in different. I will skip over it for your sake, but he essentially took to abusing animals in different ways in order to discredit his rivals, and eventually later got involved in the first electric chair, and he was one of the big promoters behind that. Even though early in his life he had been an ardent opponent of the death penalty, but he changed his mind when he saw a chance essentially to humiliate and discredit a business rival and became one of the electric chair's big backers.
I describe this book as a cautionary tale, and clearly it is. But if we're going to have some lessons to take away from it, you talk about, I mean, we depend on science more and more, it seems, to, you know, to solve the problems of our world, whether it's this virus and the vaccine, or whether it's climate change or healthcare, or even, you know, technology taking us into a future that we are just beginning to understand. But the importance of having science, but having it done in an ethical way. Expand on that for us. What do we need to do to make sure that we're not going to repeat some of this?
I think there's a couple things you can do. I think that you do have things like ethical review boards nowadays, which I think do help out a fair amount in that, again, most of the people committing these awful deeds were not, you know, sadistic or dastardly people at the beginning. They just made a series of bad choices. And when you have structures in place that can help stop them and sort of act as a circuit breaker, I do think that helps. And another thing, frankly, then the reason I wrote the book the way I did as a series of vivid stories is that when you talk about things as stories, I think that really helps. It's one thing to just put up some sort of abstract ethical rules and say, don't do this, don't do that. It's another thing when you're immersed in the moment, when you watch someone make a bad choice, when you feel the gut punch where it comes home and you see how the victim was really harmed by this thing. I think that's a more powerful way to understand it. And I think by putting it, rendering it as a story, that's just how human beings respond to things. That's how we respond to the world, is through stories. So by making them stories, hopefully people can read it and sort of understand where science has been in the past and how to kind of avoid these mistakes in the future.
You quote, I believe he's a Princeton professor, talking about pre-mortems. We talk about post-mortems when it comes to scientific research. Yep. He talks about pre-mortems. What does he mean?
It's Daniel Kahneman. He is the Nobel Prize winner. He wrote Thinking Fast and Slow. Pre-mortems basically are the opposite of post-mortems, where you sit down ahead of time, before a project starts, and you think, well, how could this project go wrong? And you try to make it, again, you render it as a story, try to make it very, very vivid, and you basically try to figure out, you anticipate problems, essentially, is what you try to do. And they found in studies that it's very effective about getting people to step back a little bit, take a wider perspective, and again, sort of act as a circuit breaker to some of these problems. So I do think you can essentially use certain psychological tricks, and I talk about these in the book, but you can use good science to fight bad science.
Mm. Well, expand on that for us.
Well, again, there's just these little psychological things you can do, like instituting a pre-mortem or other ones where you essentially use things that do work, that cause people to slow down, to think. You can look at group dynamics and what groups make good decisions. Homogeneous groups make very poor decisions. If all the people think alike, they all have a certain political background, if they all have a certain upbringing or demographic, those groups tend to make worse decisions. If you have a broader demographic reach, a broader range of thought, those groups bring different perspectives and they make better decisions. So again, you can use psychology, you can use good scientific studies to help fight bad science.
Well, let me quote you one more time, Sam. You write, many people, blithely assume that smarter people are more enlightened and ethical. If anything, the evidence runs the other way, since smart people assume they're smart enough to elude capture. You go on to write, morals also help us navigate life and prevent us from heading down certain dangerous roads in the first place. We're coming full circle, talking, I guess, back to Albert Einstein about character and morals.
Yeah, people have compared it to an engine. If you have intelligence, you have a really, really powerful engine inside of you. But morals are sort of like the steering wheel. And if you have a really powerful engine with a really poor steering wheel, that's going to be a disaster. You're going to veer off course and you're going to crash. So you need both of those things. The powerful engine helps, but you need that steering wheel. You need those morals as well. And the book is basically cases where people did not have that steering wheel.
We're going to leave it there. Sam Keen, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is called The Ice Pick Surgeon, Murder, Fraud, Sabotage, Piracy, and Other Dastardly Deeds Perpetrated in the Name of Science. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Debbie Builder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. No, she's not Debbie Builder. Diana Martinez is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. We're a girl show. Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.